Hello and welcome to the run-in to the games with Rob and Rachel. In the build-up to Paris 2024, we've been trawling the Transworld Sport archives, coming up with the most incredible stories from both the Summer Olympics and the Paralympics. And this episode, Rob, I'm excited for, because it's called Behind the Medals, and it's very much about not what stories made the back pages, but which stories also made the front pages. It's not about if you won a medal, it's about the taking part and coming back from adversity and the true Olympic spirit of the games. For me, Rob, this has been my favourite episode to research and uncover some of the most incredible stories you will ever hear. True stories of perseverance and overcoming adversity. Do you not agree with me?
Yes. I mean, listen, the Olympic Games is agenda setting, front page and back page. And we're only going to scratch the very surface, because how could we do otherwise in a podcast vodcast of this short duration for a history that goes back to 1896? But
we just sat there as well, didn't we, going, should we use this one? That's how difficult it was to pick.
It's like trying to choose between your mum and your dad or your two favourite holiday destinations. It's impossible.
It's hard.
But you can't be everywhere at once.
Some of the athletes we're going to talk about truly had some very bad luck and still bounce back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got both elements in this episode, you know, and we do have to talk about some of the scenarios that unfolded that, you know, led to a lot of thinking and a lot of introspection. But yeah, on the other end of the spectrum, there's at least two stories here. And I said this in some of the earlier episodes. There's at least two stories in here, in this episode, that deserve to be Hollywood films, and I don't know why they haven't been made. But look, if we're going to start somewhere, I've just written a children's book on the Olympics, and I didn't want to shy away from difficult scenarios. And there's three words that will immediately, if you've got any kind of understanding of the history of the Olympic Games, Black Power Salute.
Mm-hmm.
Mexico City, 1968.
It just brings up a picture.
Massive. And it's one of the iconic images of the Olympic Games right from the very beginning. It's Tommy Smith, Peter Norman and John Carlos on the podium from 1968 from an incredible world record setting 200 metres, assisted by altitude, yes. Assisted by incredible athletic ability, yes. And it's the way they tried to just shine a light on a way of life and on a series of misjustices that they felt shouldn't be hidden away from, even in a moment of great personal triumph. So, before we launch into talking about this, I think it would be pertinent to hear from Tommy Smith. And Transworld Sport went to catch up with the world record holder and Olympic champion back in 2001. And here are his reflections.
It was the silent gesture heard around the world, and people ignited a flame within themselves in the understanding of what happened, because John Carlos and Tommy Smith never said a word. It was the word that was devoured by the souls of those who saw what happened. With us saying that then, we were viewed as militant in our thinking, deranged in our basic reason to want to live, because we were different, because we wanted equality, and because we use athletics, which we were PhDs in, to highlight the issues of need. We were not supposed to do that. We were supposed to be good boys. Go up, win your gold medal, put your hand over your heart, and respect a flag that did not respect you. I don't think so.
Well, let's continue then, shall we, with what Tommy said and did when he was on the podium. Obviously, he spoke about it, going through it. And everything that Tommy and John did was deliberate, wasn't it? That was so important about it. So Tommy, he raised his right fist, and that was representing Black Power. John, his left, Black Unity. And then if you looked a bit further down, they were not wearing any socks or shoes. They went barefoot on the podium, which is absolutely never done. Maybe in the swimming pool, but very much not on track and field. And that had a message as well to do with black poverty in a very racist America at the time. They also had a scarf on, didn't he, Tommy? And that showed pride as well. There were so many different messages that they were trying to convey with every single thing they did. And this is where it gets a little bit complicated as well. It wasn't just first and third place. It was the second place athlete as well, Peter Norman from Australia. He joined in, didn't he, Rob? He actually didn't particularly put his hands up or do anything as deliberate as that, but I would say deliberate as he went and got a badge, didn't he? He went and asked someone from USA track and field team and said, can I have one of your badges? And I think the track and field member said, well, what's it for? He said, I want to get on the podium with it. And he looks at him and said, well, you're white and you're Australian. And he was a bit confused, and still that led to a lot of other issues for Peter, which nobody really talks about. But should we stick with Tommy and John for the time being?
Well, you just do them all, right. So you've touched on it there. He asked for a civil rights badge. So he didn't raise his arms. The other thing that they did on the podium, which is important to note, they bowed their heads. And that was a nod to the fact that they believed that freedom of speech did not apply to black Americans. One of the two of them said, they'll say I'm an American if I win a medal.
Yeah.
If I do something bad, they'll say I'm a Negro. So the tension at the time in America was absolutely huge. And they were simply drawing attention to the, you know, the incredible hypocrisy of them being told to raise an American flag and be proud of representing their nation, but not being able to go home and, for instance, have a meal at whatever restaurant they choose because they might be asked to leave because of the colour of their skin. And remember, this is only 8 years after Muhammad Ali was chased out of a restaurant because of the colour of his skin and famously stopped on a bridge over the Mississippi River and threw his gold medal into the Mississippi. But Tommy Smith and John Carlos were making their, you know, their representation of massive injustices only 8 years after that had happened to Ali. But Peter Norman is a massive, massive part of that story. Huge. He was 26. He was a PE teacher. He was a Salvation Army officer. And he, in particular, didn't like the tone of Australia's immigration policy set by a predominantly white set of Australian politicians. So Norman ended up, there's various, some people say that Norman was never selected again because of the fact that he joined in the protest.
Some it hasn't ever been said, but I think we all can read between the lines.
Maybe. Some people, I've read quite a lot about it in the lead up to this. There's two schools of thought. One is he absolutely was isolated as a result of the protest in 68, and that led him to some big problems. He ended up getting involved with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of looking at it is that one of the key IOC or Australian Olympic Committee officials said, look, he absolutely wasn't denied a place in Munich because he didn't come high enough up in the trials, but we should have done it. We, at the very least, we should have done a lot more to recognise his stand for fairness. But the other element of this that needs to be highlighted, and again, there should be a film made of this. Both Smith and Carlos, I believe both of them, went to Peter Norman's funeral and they read eulogies and they were pallbearers. So I think it's strange, isn't it, that Norman is probably wider recognised for his part in that protest by the Americans than he was by the Australians. But it shows you an amazing level of bravery. And of course, Smith and Carlos were immediately thrown out of the games. The chronology
that was
of
it, wasn't it?
The chronology of it, the IOC apparently said, you need to send them home. From what I read, initially, the US Olympic Committee said no. And then the IOC went back to them and said, no, no, no. If they don't go, none of your athletes compete in any event from this moment onwards. So if that version of events and that chronology is to be believed as being accurate, and it's well reported in many historical books, including the Wallachinsky that I've used for many, many years, then their arms were put behind the back of the US team to get them out. And it took a long, long time for Smith and Carlos to kind of reconcile themselves with
what happened. Well, they didn't come back to the Olympics either.
No, but I just mean in terms of being able to earn a living and lead an honest life as great role models and medal winners for their country. But I think when you're looking at that one image is so powerful. And I still think there are important shockwaves still. I wonder what 16, 17-year-old kids who feel there's still a sense of injustice, I wonder what they make of that when they look at it and when they understand the context of what was going on at the time in America back home. I wonder what youngsters in America think of that now, because I still, even though I've looked at that image dozens and dozens and dozens of times since I first started getting into the Olympics in 84, I still look at it now and feel something so powerful in what they did and how they did it. And also, they would have known, they wouldn't have been able to foresee the extent of the ramifications of doing that, but they absolutely, absolutely would have been aware that the implications would be far-reaching. So that was an incredibly brave thing to do, wasn't it? Incredibly brave.
And you mentioned their careers, obviously, as Olympic athletes were finished there. But Tommy, I think, went on to the NFL. Not a successful NFL career. He was part of kind of the fringe squad, I'm going to say, the Cincinnati Bengals. So at least he did make use of his athletic abilities. But like you mentioned, if you watch any videos of them now, very humble. Just... it led to humble kind of beings in the end, you know, no super stardom that we'd have expected from the likes of those athletes, especially if an athlete wins a gold medal.
Rewinding from 68, 32 years earlier, we had an incredibly powerful message delivered by quality of performance rather than a one-off specific gesture. To take nothing away from Smith and Carlos, I am talking about Jesse Owens winning four gold medals, 100, 200, relay and the long jump in 1936 at a Games where Hitler and the Nazi regime were wrongly trying to show that not everyone is born equal. There isn't another way of kind of emphasising that, which is complete and utter nonsense. And Jesse Owens was the man to show just how false that belief was with incredible dignity, with amazing performances. We knew he was going to be, well, the world had an idea he was going to perform really well because there was a famous meet the previous year where he'd broken six world records in 45 minutes in 1935. So there was a lot of expectation on him heading to Germany and a lot of pressure as well because he was a black African-American and because he was going to the heart of Germany for the Games. Before we get in to the discussion of one of the key figures in Olympic history, Traswell Sport were privileged enough to catch a word or two with one of his former teammates, Archie Williams, who'd won the 400 metres for America at the same Games. And we also had an opportunity to hear from another American 400 metre Olympic champion, Michael Johnson. This is what both of them had to say about Jesse Owens back in the 90s.
He had the right attitude. In other words, he wasn't cocky. He knew he was good. In other words, he didn't worry about anything. The fact that he didn't show it, he just got out there and did it. And I used to train with him. He'd kill you. If you try to keep up with him, just warming up, he'd run you to death. Just dynamite.
I think Jesse Owens is the greatest there's ever been because, I mean, Usain Bolt is phenomenal. I think I did okay, but neither of us can say, or Carl Lewis even can say, that we've done the types of things that Jesse Owens was able to do. And in such a short career compared to my career, which was 10 years long, and Carl's career, which was even longer, he had won Olympics, but broke world records in four different events, even broke world records, four different world records in one day. You know, and that's just incredible.
All the athletes going to Berlin, if they didn't fit in with Hitler's ludicrous notion of the Aryan race, none of us can imagine what they must have felt or the desire to prove how wrong that assertion was and the strength of feeling that they must have had when they arrived. And at the same time, there were still complexities going on at home. And I know we're fully focusing on Jesse here, but just to touch on Archie, I hadn't realised until I did my research for this podcast, vodcast, whatever you want to call it. Archie Williams went home for the United States after winning his gold medal in the 400 metres. I believe he had either a doctorate or a degree in mechanical engineering, and the only job he could get back home was digging a ditch. He eventually, I believe, ended up training pilots in the Second World War and did use his academia at some stage working in a high school. So these guys were dealing with mixed messages from all over the place. So their emotions going to Berlin to represent the United States as Black Americans, knowing that life wasn't exactly easy for them at home, must have been so difficult. Going back onto Owens, I think as far as shoving the notion of Aryan race down Hitler's throat.
Did I read as well that Hitler actually stormed out of the stadium?
I'm not sure because I've heard...
I did read that in a couple of articles.
I think that's unsubstantiated, but it would be lovely if it was true.
I can believe it to be true.
Yeah. One of the key things, if there's youngsters listening or watching this, go back and have a little delve online, because you'll find the information, about a German long jumper by the name of Lutz Long. And I think, even above his other three golds in the one, the two, and the relay, the friendship that Owens formed with Lutz Long, a white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, typical, seemingly Aryan poster boy, was phenomenal. So what happened? Lutz Long went over and said hello. And initially, Owens was a little bit sceptical because he was looking at this blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryan guy, trying to work out if Lutz Long was playing games with him. And I think Owens said something to him along the lines of, aren't you supposed to be part of the Aryan race? And I think Long sort of laughed and said, well, I think that's what some people think, but it might not be what everybody thinks here in Germany. They had an instant friendship and connection. And he said to Owens, look, I believe you're having a few problems here with your run-up. He said, you know you can jump 23 feet. I can't remember what the exact qualification mark was. But Long was saying to Owens, listen, you could take off a foot behind the board and you're still going to hit the required mark for the final. Why don't you just err on the side of caution? Aim your takeoff leg to hit the ground before the board. Just make absolutely certain and then we'll go again in the final. Owens did that. He made the final. And Lutz Long gave him that assistance, knowing that there was a fair chance he might be denied a gold medal in front of a home crowd, Nazi or otherwise, presumably with his friends and family there watching. They had a brilliant competition. I'm pretty sure Long matched Owens into the fifth round. And Owens then produced a monstrous effort over the last couple of rounds to beat him. They remained in written correspondence until Long was killed in action under duress in July 1943. So, to me, the fact that friendships and personal connections instantly made a complete nonsense and mockery of the notion that a white man couldn't be friends with a black man, that friendship with Lutz Long, to me, is more powerful than the other three gold medals put together. And if there's a young man or woman, it's almost quite emotional, isn't it? If there's a young man or woman hearing that story, go and read about it. Because colour and, you know, sporting rivalries, there's no barrier to friendship. There's absolutely no barrier to friendship. And I think Lutz Long shouldn't be forgotten in that story and how... You know, and how important he was in Owens making it four golds instead of three if he hadn't adjusted the run-up to qualify for the final in the first place. We do also have to talk about the issue of drugs. And there are lots of stories here, but perhaps the one that we're choosing to focus on, all we're doing here is scratching the surface, is former world record holder Tim Montgomery, who was part of the gold medal winning quartet in Sydney. Broke that world record in 2002 with 9.78 and then ended up making some bad choices. Went to jail for 8 years for drug dealing. And we had an opportunity to catch up with Tim Montgomery after he was released 8 years ago and put his life back together.
I really wanted to be this great sprinter, but I really didn't want to put in the work to be the great sprinter. So 97 came and I took a bronze medal in World Championship. Went on from there, received a huge contract, had all this money, and my world just turned to from track star to rock star. I was living a double life. And I didn't see my performance get even better. 1999, I was watching World Championships and I seen Marion Jones run the 100 meters and I'm like, who's our coach? And it happened to be Trevor Graham. They happened to train in North Carolina. And I got down there in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it was an eye-opener. It was, this is what track and field is. This is what you've been missing. This is the dark side of track and field. Do you want it? And I said, yes, I do. Once I got on performance enhancing drugs, that was the biggest key to performance. I took Victor Word as, hey, take this right here and you're gonna run fast. And I didn't care about if it killed me or what it done to me. All I wanted was speed. All I wanted was power.
Well, incredibly candid there from Tim Montgomery. It's almost that win at all costs kind of mantra. We should just wrap up. He went to jail. He initially went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. He was banned. He eventually went to jail in October 2008 and is now out rebuilding his life and coaching. Rachel, you got far closer than I did to becoming an Olympian and a world-class athlete. I guess if someone's offering you the impossible magic potion and you don't feel you can get there under any other means, you can't condone that decision, but he was absolutely desperate for the success and desperate to give himself and his future family a different way of life. I'm not making excuses for him, but can you see, as a former elite athlete, can you at least see the path that led to those decisions?
Well, firstly, I never took drugs. I never got to
that. No, I know, but can you at least see his reason?
You know, and I never got to that level. I was drug tested many times. I guess my most notable one was Commonwealth Youths. I came second. Caster Semenya beat me that day, and I was the one that was sent off, and you know, got checked here, there, and everywhere. Can I see? I'd like to say that, you know, I used to wear the badge which we had, I Run Clean. That was and is very much still a massive slogan that exists, especially in track and field. We know about the coach-athlete relationship. There's a very strong bond which is created there. If that person who you're meant to believe and trust in to take you all the way says to you, you know what, you possibly should be taking drugs, do you believe him? Question mark. Thankfully, I wasn't in a generation or in a club surrounded by people who thought that was an option. You know, for us, success bred success. And it's not like that it didn't breed success in his training camp, because there were a whole host of successful people that were training around him. Would they have achieved what they had achieved without drugs? If you've got that kind of quality, I would have said yes. But when it's dangled like a carrot in front of you and people left, right and centre who you believe and trust are telling you to take it, how difficult is that? I can't answer that question, Rob.
It's just so sad, isn't it? Because that there would have been natural ability there for him to have been on the radar of various people in the first place. And he obviously was a world-class sprinter before he made those decisions. But, you know, deep down, by the way he's rebuilt his life, he's clearly learned his lessons. He's probably deep down a nice guy. And sometimes people make really, really bad mistakes. But nonetheless, you have to work on the basis that somebody might have been denied a place in the US team in the final who had never done anything wrong, and they were denied a moment to make history for themselves and their families. Just desperately, desperately sad. But it would have been remiss of us not to have at least touched on drugs at some stage. And there's two sides to this, isn't there? If you go back to the regime in East Germany, and regime is the right word, in, you know, the 70s and the 80s, what we're talking about with Montgomery is taking drugs, knowing that you're doing so and knowing the repercussions. We've had some interesting revelations over the years from the East German regime. One such example, Transworld Sport caught up with a few years ago. Andreas Krieger was previously competing as Heidi Krieger, a women's European champion in 1986, just off the podium in the Worlds in 1987. And this is a story about unwittingly cheating by taking what she was told was a legal supplement. Really difficult subject, this, but Transworld Sport calls up with Andreas to ask him the questions as he was competing as a female back in the 80s.
When I turned 16, my coach started giving me pills. He showed me the pills. They were wrapped in silver foil, and he told me they were supplements. That everybody took them. There was nothing to worry about, and that I needed them. Back then, I trusted my trainer, so I took them. I was able to train beyond my natural pain barrier and achieve performances that any other woman would have thought abnormal. It got to a point where I didn't have a pain threshold and I would lift weights until the skin on my hands came off. And even that didn't bother me. I was always surrounded by these people, on a daily basis. I trusted them. I wasn't aware that they wanted to hurt me. What the coaches did to me was betray my trust in them, and that made me very angry. When I first found out, I was furious. I thought about taking some sort of revenge on them. But I decided that I wasn't going to waste my energy on those people, even though they hurt me, abused me, and most of all, betrayed my trust in them. I know they'll receive their punishment in the end.
Irgendwo werden sie ihre gerechte Strafe kriegen. Also als Frau hätte ich definitiv nicht mehr leben wollen.
Well, I wouldn't have wanted to carry on living as a woman. The only way for me to carry on living and surviving was as a man. And I feel like I have a new life. It's so much more positive than it ever was when I was a girl or a woman. It was the most important and necessary thing in my life.
Well, it's just so desperately sad, and you can only hope that Andreas enjoys a lot of years of contentment where he didn't when he was Heidi. And it shows you the lengths that some countries will go to try and ensure success and global glory. Now, on this episode, we're covering all sorts of stories, and some of those involve athletes who've got incredible longevity, and they wait until the very end of their careers to strike gold, and they've done 3-4 Olympic Games, maybe even 5 in the case of Sir Steve Redgrave, the British rower. But now we turn our attention to a story about a young woman who achieved all that glory at the age of 15. 3 golds, a silver and a bronze, all 3 of the individual medals, with world records as well, igniting her nation's passion for swimming. Her name was Shane Gould, and you would have thought, with the world at her feet, swimming 12 races in 8 days, that the future was paved with glory. But despite bringing all that adulation and fame back to the green and gold of Australia, she was ready to walk away just a couple of months later at the age of 16. And Transworld Sport went to catch up with her to find out her reflections a couple of decades on from setting the world afire in the pool.
It is a memorable thing and a highlight in my life. It was a pretty lonely time because I had to focus very intensely on each event. And I swam 5 individual events and 1 relay. So I did 11 races in 10 days. Some days I had 2 races each day. So I was pretty pooped afterwards, you know, pretty tired. I had an inkling, you know, deep inside me that there was something more to life than being famous and being successful, you know, being an Olympian, you know, the ultimate for any sportsman. And I didn't know what that was. And that put me into great confusion and rebellion against my parents and my coaches. And I just got very confused and didn't know what to do. So I turned my back on it all and just quit. And I've found a peace in my heart that comes from a faith in a Christian God. Some people have said you're a child prodigy. And the stress of that was too much. And I think to a certain extent that's it, but in other respects I think that you believe in divine plans. And but from 1973, when I quit, the East Germans just skidding on breaking 2 seconds left my world records over 100 metres. Now, I wouldn't have had a hope at all to have kept up with them. So I think it was probably just as well that I quit, you know, because I would have just faded into oblivion.
You mentioned it, didn't you, Rob, leading into that. Some athletes just want to continue for as long as possible. And a little bit like actually in our greatest female episode, Simone Biles, she's kind of taken this time out from gymnastics and has realised, well, hang on, if I don't come back now, 10 years in the future, I might regret stepping away from the sport. Maybe if she didn't have that success age 15, maybe kind of age 19, she would have been 18 or 19 in the next games, she would have wanted, there might have been that fire. Do you think sometimes when the success comes at such a young age, you've kind of achieved all you want to achieve? It's not uncommon to see that in sport.
Yeah, when you get these incredible bursts of global glory when you're looking at a teenager,
you can't deal with it.
It tends to either go one or two ways. Yeah. It's either the beginning of an unbelievable career that lasts 12 or 15 years, or they burn out. And it sounds as though, you know, Shane had reached a point where she recognised that for whatever reason, she'd had enough, or she didn't need it anymore. You know, she was 15. I know you're yet to become a parent. My son's 10. You know, even at the development, even if he becomes quite mature over the next few years, as an adult, you know, approaching 50, emotionally, even though a 15-year-old, a fully physically developed 15-year-old would tell you to mind your own business and that he or she was effectively an adult, they're not. At 15, there's a reason that 15-year-olds don't drive. There's a reason that 15-year-olds can't vote. There's a reason that 15-year-olds still have to have permission from their parents for various operations and bits and bobs. They're children. You know, and I'm sure she was very well looked after as a youngster, but that you're putting a gigantic amount of pressure onto a very, very tender head. You know, and in the same way that you wouldn't let a 15-year-old run a marathon because their legs aren't fully developed and it would all come too soon. You know, Shane obviously had enough and went down a different route, and that's fine.
I think that's it as well sometimes, and you hear this from a lot of athletes. If they feel like they have something to move on to, which I feel Shane possibly did, she had her faith. She spoke about that, didn't she, as well. There's not a big void that's being left. And you find that athletes go into a dark hole if they don't have that. Maybe her faith was strong enough to take her away from feeling like she was lacking something, you know, leaving sport behind her. And then she went on to have a whole bunch of children. I think it was 4 that she had in Western Australia. And she lived on a farm. She went on to do celebrity, goodness knows what, I'm a survivor, get me out of here, you name it, she did it. But I do love, Rob, that finally, I don't know if it was persuasion or what it was, she did full circle. And came, didn't she, to the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, and it was a massive part of that, which, from having that length of time out of sport, I think she was involved a bit in swimming coaching and kind of, I guess, kept her foot in the water a little bit, but such a long time away from the Games to come back and be such a statement person at Sydney, I think was a testament to what the sport had given her, and she felt like she had to come and give something back.
This episode's really fascinated both of us for different reasons, hasn't it? And there have been a crazy number of amazing stories of tenacity and bravery. Some at the beginning of an athlete's career, some coming in towards the end. And in the case of the next athlete we're going to talk about, Ana Quiro of Cuba, an incident that happened right in the middle of her career, at the peak of her powers. And for those of you unfamiliar with Ana, she was a wonderful 8 and 400 metre runner. She was unbeaten in 1988, 5 out of 5. But the Cubans had boycotted the Seoul Olympics, so we didn't get to see what she was capable of there. She'd just finished off the podium in the Rome World Championships the year before Seoul as well. She won a silver at the Worlds in 1991 and then got herself on the podium in Barcelona in 92, at which point she was at the very peak of her powers. However, in January 93, she was injured in a terrible fire while she was cooking at, I think, 7 months pregnant. She had to have a forced inducement of the baby. She lost the baby. She suffered something like 35-degree burns to her body, although her legs were not injured. And Transworld Sport caught up with Anna Kiro as she was beginning on the road to what would turn out to be an extraordinary recovery in 1993.
It really was a great motivating force for me. I had to set myself real objectives after what had happened. From the very first day that I arrived in hospital, I told my companions that I was going to return to running. In order to get things in this life, you have to fight. I don't know if it's going to be a gold medal, a silver medal, a bronze, or be among the 8 finalists. But, well, I'm going to fight for a place on the team at the 96 Olympics in Atlanta.
Incredible. 35% of her body was burnt. How do you come back from such an injury, such a horrific injury like that? Like you said, I think it was probably because it was in the middle of her career. She knew how much more she had to give. The mental strength just comes through there. Not only did she come back, she came back just as strong, if not stronger. She went on to win a world championship gold and then a Olympic silver as well. And you said it, how many times did she go under the 2-minute barrier?
Every year for a decade.
Wow.
And that in that era, that's phenomenal, incredible. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal.
In that era, we were teetering on the 2, and if you got under, you were a superstar. But the fact that she did it every single year she competed, I mean, hats off to her. That was quite the story. Rob, we're going to turn tact because we need to go into something a bit more lighthearted. Don't start laughing because he knows what's about to come.
This is brilliant.
Sometimes.
This is a great story. I love this story.
Sometimes people really, 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 really want to be Olympians. Sometimes people don't really even know what the Olympics are. And just for some reason or another, they get thrust in to becoming an Olympian. And that's what our next athlete had the honour of becoming. It was Sydney, 2000, and there was a man from Equatorial Guinea who basically was plucked out of obscurity because at the time the IOC wanted to encourage more countries to participate in the Games. So they kind of said, right, we're going to pick someone from Equatorial Guinea and bring them to the Games. They decided this athlete as well should do the 100-metre freestyle in the pool. But the athlete had never swam before. This athlete was Eric the Eel Musambani, and we caught up with him 2 years after he had the opportunity of a lifetime, which I'm going to say, Rob, he grabbed with both hands.
2 months before the Games, we had a competition in the swimming pool where I came first. But I didn't know at the time that I'd made it to the Olympics. My preparations weren't very good and didn't even have a coach. So I used to train on my own. The first time I saw the 50-metre pool, well, I thought it must be 100 metres. I'd never seen such a big pool in my life. When they told me it was only 50 metres, I got scared because it was very big and very long. I got scared as well because I knew that everybody was going to be looking only at me, and I wasn't sure if I'd be able to finish. But when I realized that they were just looking at me, as I was the only one swimming, I felt I had to finish the race. I couldn't hear the people clapping. I only started hearing after the first length. And by that time, I was very tired. I couldn't feel my arms, they were so heavy. But when I noticed the people cheering and clapping, it really gave me the strength to finish the race.
I just love that story, and I can remember watching it at the time. Now, some real purists would say there's no place for a Musambani at the Olympic Games, but I would firmly disagree. He didn't ask to be plucked from nowhere and put in that position, but he finished the race. He had never, ever swum competitively. He'd only taken up swimming. in the January of that year, and the hotel pool in which he was training was so expensive, he was only allowed in there for an hour at 6 a.m. once a week on a Sunday. And I think...
Do you know what he did other times? He went in the lake as well, in the river, and the fishermen would watch him and kind of cheer him on and say, you know, correct his stroke, which I thought was amazing as well.
What I loved about that story, it was so genuine and it just happened to unfold in that way because the other two swimmers false started and he was the only one in the water. And the crowd kind of sensed that something truly amazing was unfolding. That wasn't him trying to engineer a scenario to then become a reality star or a social media star. Social media would have been in its infancy then anyway, but it was so genuine. And I think that's why the Australian public went for it. And look, the Olympic Games does produce moments like that. There was a British triathlete, Mark Jenkins, excellent triathlete. Something happened with the wheel of his bike in Athens in 2004. It was so badly damaged, he was not able to get off and push the bike along the road. The only way he could get to the finish of the bike section was by hoisting the bike on his shoulders and running in bare feet, which he did for the last 2 kilometres and finished last by miles. The Olympics does that. Where in another event, that person like Mark Jenkins or Eric the Eel would get to the turn of the 50 or see the bike wrecked and go, I can't go any further.
Or just in his case, see the pool and go, I'm going to walk back up.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what he did.
And then one other tiny example. And I was commentating on a fairly bog standard heat of the women's 5,000 metres in Rio. There was a New Zealand girl who's born in Britain, I think, Nikki Hamlin, clashed with an American girl called Abby D'Agostino. They both tripped over each other and fell down. One of them had really, really badly injured her knee and her meniscus, and they literally limped the last lap together. That in that instant when they both went down, they could have been crying, they could have been full of anger, such as was the case with Mary Decker when she tripped over Zola Budd in the 3000 in 84. We haven't got time to go into that. But Hamlin and D'Agostino helped each other across the finish line. They were both advanced to the final, and they were both given a fair play award. Would they have done that instinctively if it had not been the Olympic Games? I don't know. There's something very, very special about the Olympics. And Musambani is a great part of history from a brilliant edition of the Olympiad. And I think most Australians and most people who are in that stadium would smile if you asked them to reminisce about that moment, even now, 24 years later.
You've got to go and watch it because I rewatched it as well. You laugh as well as smile, but laughing with him.
With him, not at him.
Yeah, exactly.
Massive difference.
But he's also laughing at it as well and laughing at the situation he's been placed in. Like you mentioned, only began swimming in the January. That was 8 months before he was going to go on the global stage with the Olympics and everybody's going to watch him. And even more so, the fact that he was swimming on his own because he thought he'd got disqualified, if you remember. He thought because they jumped in together that he must have done something wrong. He looked round at the official and said, no, you've got to swim. Can you imagine your first Olympic Games? You don't really know anything about it. You've been thrust here. You have to swim a heat on your own, Rob Walker. Well, I don't think I'd be so brave.
Well, you don't know, do you? But it was an incredible moment. Now, we're just about at the end of this episode. It would last 5 hours if we carried on. There's so many unbelievable stories. We've got to turn our attention to a moment. We've talked about people cheating. We've talked about newcomers, Musambani, you know, crawling across the finish line. What about that extraordinary scenario in the men's marathon in Athens in 04 when everybody was wondering whether Paul Turgat would finally manage to upgrade silver in Atlanta over the 10 and silver in Sydney over the 10 to a marathon title after finishing second to Haile on so many occasions. He was a world record holder. He was on fire. Turgat in the end, and he's an unbelievably great guy, Turgat in the end was just a name further down the list of finishers because we have this incredible story. The race was eventually won by Stefano Baldini, brilliant, brilliant championship racer. Not the quickest man you've ever watched, but fantastic at peaking at the right time. But the real story of that race was Vandeli de Lima, the Pan American champion, who I think had won Tokyo in about 96, big city marathon. So there was some clues there that he was a decent runner, but he wasn't particularly fast. He was leading, and if you remember, was knocked to the ground by somebody making a protest about something.
I remember.
and he suddenly managed to get up off the ground with his rhythm completely shattered. His adrenaline would have been soaring, and he managed to hang on for the bronze. It was an unbelievable moment. I was there in the stadium watching him finish in the aftermath of that. More of that in a moment. This is what De Lima had to say to Transworld Sport the year after his most extraordinary journey to Olympic bronze.
It was a complete shock, which really unsettled me, both mentally and physically. It was such a sudden thing. I started to feel a lot of pain in my muscles when I got going again. But despite everything, I never lost my focus, which was very important, and I managed to carry on. It was a very difficult moment, and I don't think another athlete would have stayed in the race. I was very happy with the reception I got from the crowd, because from the moment I entered the stadium, from the moment I stepped into the arena, from the moment I knew that the bronze was mine, guaranteed, I had this awesome feeling of achievement, like something extrasensory. It was a spontaneous moment, one of happiness and realization. At that point, I'd already forgotten about all the negative things that had happened, about the incident earlier in the race. I've had many commercial offers based on the incident, but I can't accept anything that would connect my image to the image of that man. I prefer people to see the true effort I put in, to see the value in my sport. That's my achievement, getting to the 36-kilometre mark over 20 seconds ahead of the second-placed runner, heading for the gold. I'll never know if I would have won, but just being there then, that was my achievement.
I mean, that was iconic. It was 4 miles to go. He was leading the marathon, and this protester, let's call him, comes out of nowhere. And we've seen that happen. They try and make a statement, don't they, on the world's biggest stage. Comes out of nowhere, runs straight almost across the motorbike as well, because motorbikes obviously are filming the athletes, especially the leader, and kind of grabs De Lima, pushes him into the crowd. I don't think he completely falls over, Rob. I could be wrong, but it looks like he's up and back out super quickly. It doesn't look like it took that much time out of him, but it doesn't matter how much time it took out of him. Can you imagine what happened mentally? Straight after that, all you're doing is processing what on earth just happened. You have no idea what just happened. I'm sure for him, he felt like it happened in a couple of seconds, but it was probably a lot more than that. I'm sure it lasted about 15 seconds. You said you were there watching. But
I was in the stadium.
You're in your stride. You've got 4 miles to go. Oh. You think you're on for possibly the gold medal, and then you're completely taken off your stride. It transpired that it was a rogue priest.
I think
who
he'd
wanted
done
a
something
spread.
At Formula One or
he
something
wanted
in previous years.
A message from God, basically saying that God was coming again. Something a little bit ludicrous. Anyway, he was involved in that. But he did go on, like we said, to take the bronze medal. But not only that medal, the Pierre de Coubertin medal as well, for sportsmanship at the Games, isn't it? It's awarded at the end of the Games to the person that shows true Olympic spirit. And it's not always the winners, is it, that we mentioned that come out as a legend. He came out as an absolute legend in the game.
He was so magnanimous after that. I mean, I was in the stadium because I had half a day off and I desperately wanted to see Turgat finally get gold after his silvers in Atlanta and Sydney, because I'd been to Kenya and I'd interviewed Turgat the previous year and he was putting in some absurd mileage, like 250 kilometres a week. It was absolutely mind-blowing. I went on a run with him and he just blew me away in the Rift Valley. So I went to see Turgat and I was in the stands and we could see it on a big screen. And I haven't watched it back. My memory of it is that he was pushed over. You say he was in a crowd. It doesn't matter.
No.
Whatever. You just couldn't believe, having run 5 marathons, not that fast, your rhythm in the last few miles is so important. And it's so easy for something to knock your concentration and your confidence or your sense of safety. I think he was in the process of being caught by Baldini.
You'll never know.
He was running the race of his life, as was Baldini. As I said, look, Baldini is an unbelievable championship runner. Baldini came in, big cheers, you know, it's an amazing performance. The Italians have got a great history when it comes to the marathon. You know, Gerlinde Bourdain in 1988, just some great, great Italian male and female marathon runners over the years. So Baldini comes in, second place comes in. And then what happened, De Lima had a big enough advantage, funnily enough, and so disappointingly for John, over John Brown of Great Britain, yeah. he then since has gone on to represent Canada. But De Lima came into the finishing funnel, and it was an amazing setting. And I know some people are listening to this on a podcast as opposed to a vodcast. Imagine him going left and right, mimicking a plane.
Rod looks like, yeah, he looks like an aeroplane right now.
Like a child would.
Yeah.
He was veering from left to right, so relieved that he was still on the podium. What was incredibly unfortunate was that John Brown, the Briton who happened to be in fourth, was closing the gap on De Lima coming up towards the line. He, I think, would have, if you were behind De Lima and therefore not able to have seen what had gone on with 4 miles to go,
he would not have.
He wouldn't have known that De Lima was not doing anything disrespectful. He was showing incredible relief to everyone there that he'd managed to finish on the podium. For Brown, it was an absolute sickener because he'd missed a bronze by 7 seconds in Sydney, finishing fourth, and that was him missing bronze by 15 seconds in Athens, finishing behind De Lima. And I remember watching De Lima being enveloped by a phalanx of photographers and journalists at the end, desperate to talk to him. And then this poor, forlorn figure of John Brown, slumped shoulders, a second successive fourth in the Olympic Games, trudging off. Your heart went out to him. But De Lima absolutely deserved that Baron Pierre de Coubertin medal because he took that moment on the chin. And he grabbed an opportunity for an Olympic slice of history with both hands and fully deserves to still be being spoken about 20 years later.
Well, and then obviously what happened at Rio 2016 as well. He was invited, wasn't he, there as well, back to his home Olympics and lit the cauldron, which was a special moment for him. You know, regardless of if he finished gold or silver, bronze for him on that day was the best possible place and the best possible outcome to still go down history for his country. There are so many more stories we could talk about. Conscious that we could go on all day. Rob definitely could go on all week with these, but that is it from this episode. Next up, a bit more maybe up to date, I'm going to say. Ones to watch.
Yes, and there are many.
It's going to be great. We're going to talk about our favourites who we're excited to see. So definitely come back and join us for that one.